strength of the force, because any theory which has them both in has to also deduce how strong is the gravity. If we take in some natural units, like the strength of attraction, of repulsion between two electrons due to electricity, and the attraction of the two electrons due to their masses, that's the way to compare them. So you can't say, let's compare 2 gram weights with 2 unit charges, because a gram weight is our own personal interest, and a unit charge is something we cooked up ourselves. But if we cook up nature's universal charge, the electron, and nature's universal mass, say, well, within a factor 2,000, you could put a proton here, but it's only a factors. Then we can measure the ratio of the electrical repulsion to the gravitational attraction. This ratio is independent of the distance and is some fundamental law. The ratio is given on the next slide between gravitation and electricity. The gravitational attraction is relative to the electrical repulsion between two electrons, 1 divided by 4.17 times 10 to the 42. I've made some attempt to write that out in a more conventional notation. Well, first, to give you an impression of the size or lack of size of this thing, and second, to teach you what it means, why it's useful to learn how to write 10 to the 42. Now, have the lights, please. Now, the question is, where does this large number come from? It's not an accidental large number, like the large number, which is the ratio of the volume of the Earth to the volume of a flea, because I pick out the Earth and the flea. But here, it's the same object. It's an electron, and it's two aspects, two natural aspects of the same thing. This number is not something, it's just like the number of atoms in the Earth is large. That's because the Earth is big. The number of atoms in something else is small. But you can't get anything natural which has any other ratio than this fantastic number. It's a natural constant, so it's something deep in nature. Where can such a tremendous number come from? Some say that someday you'll find the universal equation, and in the equation, one of the roots will be this number. If you show that to a mathematician, he was very upset. It's very hard to find an equation for which a natural root is such a fantastically large number. So other possibilities have been thought of to explain this very large number. One of the possibilities that's interesting is to relate it to the age of the universe. You see, you have to find another large number somewhere. The age of the universe, well, in what? In years? No, because years are natural. I mean, they're not natural. They're just human. Well, I mean, they're earthy. And to get something natural, we should take, let's say, the time it takes in a light to go across a proton, which is 10 to the minus 24 seconds. Now, if you compare the time it takes light to go across a proton or an electron with the age of the universe, the answer is 10 to the 42. It has about the same number of zeros running off the end of it as that other number. And so it's been proposed that the gravitational constant is related to the age of the universe. If that were the case, then the gravitational constant that we call constant would change with time, because as the universe got older, then the ratio of the age of the universe to the time it takes light to go across the proton would be gradually rising, very slightly, but rising. And so the gravitational constant would change. Is it possible that the gravitational constant is changing with time? It's because the changes are so small, it's quite difficult to be sure. The only thing that I could think of was the following. Others have thought of it too. I shouldn't have said more. That if it changed, if the age of the universe is 10 to the 10 years, and we ask how much, what the effect would be of the change occurring during the last 10 to the 9th years, or 1 billion years, which is approximately the age from the earliest life on the Earth to now, this is 1 part in 10. And so the gravity constant would change by 10%. Now, it turns out if you figure out the behavior of the sun, the balance between the weight of material and the rate at which energy is generated in the sun, that you can deduce that if the gravity were 10 times weaker or, say, stronger, say, 10 times stronger in the past, or 10 times weaker in the past, doesn't, let me take stronger, I should have figured it the other way, though, then the sun would be much brighter by, I think, the sixth power of the gravity constant. And also, if you figure out what happens to the orbit of the Earth when the gravity is changing, you'd find the Earth was closer in. So altogether, you'd get more heat at the Earth by about 100 degrees centigrade, and all the water would have not been in the sea, but in the air, boiled. And so life wouldn't have started in the sea. So I guess that it can't change, but it's not a very happy argument. It's a little complicated. So far as we know, we don't think that the gravity constant is changing with the age of the universe, but the arguments are not absolutely dead, too. Now, another thing that's very interesting about, well, now that's enough of that, but I want to talk about something else, which is the fact that the force of gravitation is proportional to the mass. Now, what I meant by the mass, I told you, which was how hard it is to hold something that's going around in a circle. If the force of gravity is exactly proportional to the mass, then two objects, one heavy and one light, both going in around something else in the same circle, at the same speed, will stay together. Because to make something go in a circle takes a force which is stronger for a bigger mass, as we define mass that way. But the gravity is stronger for a given mass, in just the right proportion, so that the two objects will go around together. If one is inside the other, for example, they'll stay inside it. It's a perfect balance. It won't come down or up. It'll just stay there. And so inside a spaceship, Gagarin or Titov would find things weightless. If they let go of a piece of chalk, it will go around the sun, the Earth. He hasn't gone around the sun yet, anyway. It will go around the Earth with exactly the same way as the whole spaceship does, and so it will remain in space relative to him. So it's very interesting that this force is exactly proportional to the mass with great precision, because if it weren't exactly proportional, then there would be some weight effect here. So yeah, but so what? So maybe it's... There's also the fact that we're going around the sun. The sun is pulling the Earth and it's pulling me. But I don't feel anything from that because we're going around together. So relative to one another, I and the Earth, there's no net forces. The fact that the force of gravitation is exactly proportional to the mass means that the weight of an object here is proportional to the mass. If I take two objects and measure their mass by swinging them in standard circles at standard speeds, find that I need twice as much pull to hold one than the other, then I weigh them on a balance, I'll find one is twice as heavy. That's just the same statement again. But that's a property of the law of gravitation. This has been checked with enormous accuracy by an experiment first done by a man named Voss and done more recently by Dickey, and the effect is that they checked with several substances and the masses and weights are exactly proportional within one part in a billion or less at the present time, which is a remarkable experiment. There's other features that I haven't the time to discuss. I wanted to discuss Einstein's modifications. The law of gravity, after all this excitement, is not right. But it was modified by Einstein to take into account those... You see, there's one feature. According to this, the effect is instantaneous. That is, if I would move this mass, I would feel right away a new force here because of the new position of that mass. And so I could send signals at instantaneous speed. But he argued there are other arguments that suggest that that's wrong and that you can't send signals faster than the speed of light. So the law must be wrong. And by correcting it to take account of delays and so on, he had a new law, which is called Einstein's law of gravitation. But I don't have the time now to describe it. One feature of it, though, that is quite easy to understand is this. In the Einstein relativity theory, anything that has energy has mass. And the mass in this sense, that it's attracted by gravitation. So even light, which has an energy, has a mass. So when a light beam, which has energy in it, comes past the sun, there's an attraction for the light beam from the sun, which means that the light doesn't go straight, but it's deflected. So that when the telescope looks at the star, it sees it in a place where it isn't. I mean, it looks like it's deflected. So during an eclipse of the sun, for example, the stars in around the sun should be deflected out from where, apparently out from where they would look if the sun weren't there. And this has been observed. But I think that I'm better off not going any further in that now. I'll try to tell you about that on some other lecture. Finally, I would like to compare gravitation to the other theories, the atomic theories. In recent years, we discovered all matter is made out of these tiny particles and that they have all these funny interactions and nuclear forces and so on. None of these forces, nuclear forces or electrical forces, have yet been found to explain the gravitation. And the quantum mechanical aspects of nature, which is that on a very small scale, nature acts in a new way, has not yet been carried over to gravitation. In the first place, in practice, when the scale is so small that you need a quantum effect, the gravitational effects are so weak by that tremendous number, like inside an atom, where the electrical forces are one unit, The gravitational forces are 10 to the minus 42 units, which is so small you can't see. So that any need for a quantum theory of gravitation has yet not been developed. On the other hand, for consistency of our physical theories, it would be nice to see if the Newton's laws modified to Einstein's law and modified once more to be consistent with the uncertainty principle. This last modification has not yet been completed. That's the way it stands today. Thank you.
This lecture, Quantum Behavior, was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on April 3, 1962, at the California Institute of Technology.
I just have a few remarks. First, in the subject of light that we've been taking up till now, I would like to explain to you, in comparison to the rest of the field of light, that we've done almost everything. There are only two phenomena which we haven't dealt with, and one is the light or electromagnetic waves confined in cavities or in pipes, and the other is total internal reflection, both of which we'll take up in the sophomore year. Then we'll have done all of the important phenomena in electromagnetic radiation. It's a rather remarkable achievement. I appreciate that we have gone through some very thick thickets, when we did particularly the theory of the index of refraction. But in order, I thought it would be interesting for you to try to see then if you could understand all the phenomena essentially of light. And the main principles I have summarized up there for anybody who wants to write such a summary. Of course, you should. The point is that this is the bare bones of the ideas, and they should be absolutely coldly understood inside out by the time we're through. That's what's left when the whole thing is disintegrated again, because from that you can rebuild everything if you have enough ingenuity. But if you lose some of those pieces, then you can't rebuild anymore. So that's the bottom of the rock bottom foundation. The next subject that we intend to take up is the theory of behavior matter on a relatively large pieces of matter, especially the thermal properties, heat, and so on. In discussing it, we'll find that the classical theory fails almost immediately because it has to do with the atomic particles, but we'll only deal with the classical part. That is the only part which we can understand from classical physics. But it isn't very successful. Unlike the theory of light, where especially at long wavelengths, the classical theory is an excellent approximation and you don't have to worry about the photons, in the case of matter, you get into trouble relatively early. Now, one way, of course, is continuously to skirt away from the quantum mechanical effects. But I thought that I would interpose here two entertainment lectures, if you would like to call them that, which describe the quantum properties of materials or the quantum ideas so that you have some idea of what it is we're leaving out more than to learn. To be specific, this particular lecture that I'll give today will undoubtedly be one which I should give later when you're about to learn about the quantum mechanics. And I think I don't know what I'll teach in the sophomore year yet, but if I ever did come, if you ever did come to learn quantum mechanics, that course should begin with this lecture that I'm about to give, and it will be done over again, the same lecture. So or if you have a copy of it after it's printed, that would be useful too. So I'm now going to give you, for that reason, because when skirting about the edges of the quantum mechanics, it's a good idea to have some idea what's in that dark cloud over there, that the purpose of these two lectures is to tell you something about that. So I begin with the lecture on quantum behavior. Things on a very small scale behave like nothing that you know about or that you have any direct experience about. They do not behave like waves. They do not behave like particles. They do not behave like clouds, nor like billiard balls, nor like weights on springs, nor like anything that you know anything about. And the gradual accumulation of experimental information on the atomic and small-scale behavior during the early part of the first quarter of the 20th century, which determined how, gave some inclinations on how they did behave, produced an increasing confusion which was gradually resolved finally resolved, in 1926 and 27 by Schrödinger, Heisenberg, and born. And they finally obtained a consistent description of the behavior of matter on a small scale. The main features of that description, it is my purpose to explain to you today. Because this behavior is so unlike ordinary experience, it's very difficult to get used to, and it appears peculiar and mysterious to everyone, both to the novice and to the experienced physicist. I myself, for example, do not thoroughly understand it, and it's perfectly reasonable that I should not, because all my experience or intuitions apply to large objects, and I know what they ought to do, and the things on a small scale just don't do that way. So I have to learn it in a sort of abstract or imaginative fashion, and not by direct experience. Historically, the electron, for example, looked like a particle, and in the early beginnings of the, in about 1920-something odd, it was found that it behaved in many respects like a wave. On the other hand, light at first, well, at Newton's, after Newton, people thought it was a particle. Then they discovered, as we have here, that it looks like a wave. Then in the beginning of the 20th century, they discovered it was like a particle again. And as I say, it's like neither. But one great simplification is this, that an electron behaves just like light. That is, the quantum behavior of these things, electrons and photons and so on, are the same. They are all particle waves, or whatever you want to call it, quantum particles. And so when we learn about the properties of what I'm going to use in my example, mostly electrons, but it doesn't make any difference, it's the same for no matter what particle, including photons or light, that I would use. Well, in this lecture, I wish to tell you about the mysterious behavior right away in its most strange form. It's usual in such courses and to first point out situations where the quantum mechanical behavior can be more or less understood roughly, more or less, by classical ideas, and to gradually build up a feel for the subject that way. But in fact, I believe that the feel which one builds up in this way is a feeling that with a little more thought and ingenuity, the old ideas would account for everything. This erroneous impression derives from a special selection of phenomena which such a method of presentation leads to. It only meets, therefore, you select phenomena for which classical ideas would meet with a misleading partial success. And so what I've chosen is a phenomenon in which it's impossible, but absolutely impossible to explain in any classical way, and which has the heart of the quantum mechanics in it, and it's the only mystery. I will not explain the mystery in the sense of telling you where the mystery, why it's, how it works, but I'll tell you, I'll tell you how it works. And in telling you how it works, I will have told you how all peculiarities of quantum mechanics are always the same thing. So I have selected a particular experimental situation to describe, which contains the peculiarities of quantum mechanics in acute form. And any other place where you have peculiarities is just another example of the same thing. So we're right at the heart of the subject. Now, to best understand the true quantum behavior of, say, electrons, we shall compare and contrast its behavior with the more familiar behavior of particles like bullets or waves like water waves in a typical, particular experimental setup, which I'll describe. Well, first, I describe the behavior of bullets in this particular experimental setup. I have here a piece of armor plate with a hole in it. And behind it is a machine gun for shooting bullets. Then there's another piece of armor plate further away with two holes in it. And then over here is sand or something to pick up the bullets, or some kind of a detector of bullets. That symbol represents the detector of the bullets. And we'll suppose that the bullets can go through, so that the machine gun wobbles and the bullets go through the holes. Some of them, most of them, ones that go through are the only ones I'm interested in. And then when they go through the holes, perhaps they ricochet off the corners of the holes or something. It's not very complicated. Now, the first, what we're going to talk about is what happens over here. Now, the first thing that I would emphasize is that these bullets, I'm going to imagine, are not real bullets, but they are indestructible bullets. They can't break in half. So, okay? They're absolutely indestructible bullets, which is a little bit imaginary, but let's say that. First, then, what happens is that they always arrive in lumps.
When you find something coming to the detector, what comes is a bullet. Boom. If the number of bullets per second is decreased very much, so it just goes boom, and then boom, and so on, then at any moment, if you had a whole lot of detectors here, only one of them will go off. Only one of them will record the arrival of a bullet, and not the others. And what comes is always the same amount of stuff. So that's lumps. That's what I mean by arrives at lumps. And what we're going to measure as a function of this height across here is the probability, or the frequency, well, the probability of arrival of a lump as a function of x, as a function of the height of P. By the probability of arrival, I mean something like this, that if you do the experiment for 10 years and you count how many bullets arrive and divide it by the total number of bullets, arrive at x, rather, and divide by the total number of bullets, that's the odds that the bullet arrives at x, relative odds that it arrives at x. That's the probability, or the frequency. It doesn't make any difference. Now, the second important aspect of this is the following. Now, if we actually make this experiment, presumably, I mean, it's slightly imaginary. I don't know if it's ever been done quite like this. But anyhow, the distribution of bullets will look something like this. That is, behind this hole, we get a large extra and a lot of bullets, and they're spread around because of the ricocheting and so on. And behind this one, you get a certain amount, and you get a kind of a curve like this. And this is the answer for the number of bullets as a function of the height. Now I have here two holes, which I call hole number one and hole number two, and I point out an interesting thing. First, I do the experiment over again, only this time I close hole number two. Well, when I close hole number two, I move the whole curve down. Well, no, let's do it on another blackboard. If I, this now represents the final arm or the sand which picks up the bullet. If I close hole number two, I get a curve something like this, which I call P1, the probability of bullets arriving when only hole one is open. And then if I close the other hole, I get a distribution of bullets like that, which I call P2, which is the number that arrives only number two is open. And the remarkable, not remarkable, but the important thing to emphasize here is that P does equal P1 plus P2. I call that no interference, that the effect with both holes open is the same as with each hole open alone added together. Well, let's call that no interference for a reason which you'll see when I just learned today how I spelled interference wrong for the last 25 lectures. There, all right. That's bullets. Now let's contrast this with water waves. So this time I have a line of barges, or a wall in the water. There's the surface of the water here. And here somebody is jiggling up and down all the time and making waves which come out, water waves. And then I have lines of barges up here which stop the waves, except there's a hole between the barges in this particular fashion. And then there's a shoreline over here, or another wall or so. And the waves come up to here. And I measure something here. I measure what's the motion. The waves, the water jiggles up and down. We'll suppose that this is jiggling periodically, so it makes nice waves. And I measure the jiggling up and down. Now, the first thing is that the effect that I'm talking about here can have any size if the jiggler over here, I'm assuming there's no other source of winds, nothing else, all right? If the jiggler over here just moves very small amount, then there's just a little bit of wiggling over here. If it moves more, there's more. And it can have any amount of wiggling over there whatsoever. Whatsoever. I'm getting poetic. Now, what we're going to measure will be the motion of the water, but in a technical sense, as you know, what I will call the energy of the water, or more specifically, the mean square of the displacement. Because the energy is proportional to the square. Now, we take the square to measure the motion of the displacement, the intensity of the waves, or the energy carried in the water waves. And now we discover, if we measure that as a function of position x, a very interesting and remarkable curve, which looks more or less... I'm not going to get it exactly right, but we'll try to do something. Some kind of a curve. Complicated. Very complicated curve. And you all know about this. This curve is produced, if you know, remember, by the fact the waves spread from here, and then each one of these makes a new source. And then in different places, like here, for instance, the crests from both come together and make a strong wobbling, while at a point here, because of the difference in the distance and the finite wavelength, the definite wavelength, they come opposite each other, and the net effect is no motion, and so we get such a curve. Let me remind you that if I take hole number one and hole number two and close it, I'll just draw it down here symbolically. If I close hole number two and I measure the intensity of the water, which I'll call number one, the intensity of the action at behind, if hole number two is closed, that is, if only hole number one is open, looks like this. If I close off these waves, there's no interference pattern. And if I close off the other one, there's none either. And so I get I1 and I2. And the intensity I is not equal to I1 plus I2. That says we do have interference. I spelled it wrong again. In fact, as you know, the law behind this thing is simple. The law behind this curve is simple. That I can be represented as a certain height of the water squared. This is the true law. Now, not an inequality, but an equality. The height of the water is the height of the water from the first one plus the height of the water from the second source. The intensity that you would get for one of them closed would just correspond to the height with number one, while the other one would be height number two squared. And the square of the sum is not the sum of the squares. The difference we call interference. So, okay, that's just to remind you of things well known. Strictly speaking, I should say the average over time of h squared, or mathematically we can do it with complex numbers, and then it's just the absolute square of h. Okay, that's fine. Now let's take the case of electrons. All right, now we make the experiment this way. We take a piece of tungsten. These experiments which I describe have not actually been done in precisely this way. There's enormous numbers of experiments, but I've imagined one and I computed what the effect should be from quantum mechanics and used that because it's more idealized and easier to understand than the actual experiments which have been done. But we'll take this. We imagine a piece of tungsten with a filament behind with a definite voltage so the electrons come out with a definite energy. And then there's another piece of tungsten with two holes in it. And then over here, we put a detector, which could be a wire, which measures the charge which comes in from the electrons, or some other way of detecting electrons. Now, first, with electron, it comes in lumps. It's necessary to understand that it comes in lumps, and so I emphasize that point as follows. First, when you get an effect in here, you only get clicks with a sufficiently sensitive detector. You get a series of clicks. When an electron arrives, it delivers a certain energy, and it delivers a certain charge, and it delivers one amount, each electron, always. Boom. No halves. Secondarily, if you have more than one, if you have sources all over the place, then you do sometimes get counts in more than one at the same time. But if you'll decrease the brightness of the filament or decrease the number of electrons, the intensity of the source, lower and lower, then less and less often does it accidentally occur that two go off. In fact, at the very lowest sources, it's only one or another of these that go off at a time. If one goes off, the others are not going off. Or if this goes off, it's not there. So it's lumps. No question. So we are going to measure the probability of arrival of a lump of such a thing, of an electron or a lump or whatever you want, or a lump, all right, as a function of x. And the result of the experiment is a rather complicated curve. It looks like this. That's the answer. That's the way electrons go. Now I'd like to discuss, to analyze this curve, to try to understand the behavior of the electron. Well, the first thing I say is that since it comes in lumps, the lump, the electron, is either coming through hole number one or through hole number two. Inasmuch as we're going to discuss this in some detail, I've written that remark at the top of the board and called it Proposition A, so that I can refer to it perpetually without saying the same sentence over and over. So we suppose that the electron, of course, since it's a lump, either goes through number one hole or through number two hole. So that all the electrons which arrive at a given counter here after several hours of work, I mean, to get the number of them per hour, are electrons which can be divided into two classes, those which come through number one and those which come through number two hole. And so this curve must be a sum of the effects of the electrons which come through number one and the electrons which come through number two. And this we can, of course, test experimentally. For first, we will measure the total number of electrons which come through hole number one. In order to measure the number which comes through hole number one, we set up the same experiment. But we close hole number two with a little piece of tungsten. And so we find how many arrive at a given place coming through hole number one. Those are the ones which come through hole number one. And we get a curve something like this, which we'll call P1. We do the same experiment the other way to find P2, the number which arrived through hole number two. And we get another curve, P2. Now, it is evident that the sum of those two curves, which is the sum of the ones that arrive from one and ones that arrive from two, is not the right answer when both holes are open. That is to say, it shows interference. Or P is not equal to P1 plus P2. Now, you say, well, that means, presumably, that it's not true that the lumps go either through hole number one or hole number two. Because if they did, I could analyze them this way. Perhaps they go more complicatedly. That they split in half. No, they can't. They always come in lumps. Whenever we're finished, we find a lump. Whenever we find an electron, it's a lump. All right. Some of them go through one, and then they go around through two a few times and back and forth in there. Or they do something very complicated. So that by closing number two hole, the chance of arrival here is changed. Notice, for example, there's a point here in which none arrive when both holes are open. But if I close one hole, the lumps begin to arrive. Or if I close the other hole, they arrive. But if I leave it open for the lumps to go through, they don't come anymore. So that's quite mysterious. You see, the more you look, the more mysterious it is. And so many inventions have been concocted to try to explain this curve in terms of lumps going around in complicated ways through the holes, in a classical sense, and none of them succeed. None of them have succeeded. You see, the argument would be then that if we close one, we're not getting the number that are coming through number hole number one in that experiment exactly, so it doesn't add up right. But no direct method has succeeded. And one of the strange features of it, the thing that shows that it's going to be darn tough to make an explanation of this thing with a complicated mechanical hocus-pocus about going through 70 the holes back and forth and so on, or that the electron splits in several pieces and comes together again, or any other complicated mechanism, is this, that this curve is extremely simple. The mathematics of this curve is extremely simple. This curve can be represented this way. You can write it as that the size of it is the absolute square of some complex number, which I call, say, phi. And that the phi can be written as a sum of two phis, and that the phi from each one, that the P1 that I observed over there was the square of one of them, and the P2 was the square of the other. Yeah, I'm, of course, saying that this is the same pattern as is obtained for the waves. This curve is the same as this curve. So we get the pattern of waves, which is simple mathematically, in a situation that we can't expect. They're complex mechanical machinery, presumably. So we therefore conclude that we must do this. In quantum mechanics, we calculate the intensity of waves. By intensity, I mean technically not the energy per square centimeter per second, but the square of the amplitude. We calculate the intensity of waves in a given circumstance, and we interpret
the number as the probability of arrival. That's the rules. Incidentally, it turns out rather amusingly for your interest that in quantum mechanics, in classical mechanics, we should take the mean over time of the square of the wave, and we use complex numbers as a trick to help us in the analysis. But in quantum mechanics, it turns out that the waves themselves are complex directly, that these are all complex numbers directly. And we shouldn't take any real parts. It's the whole complex number. That's a technical point because the formulas are the same. Okay, so since the probability of arrival through hole one and through hole two is given so simply and is not equal to the probability P1 plus P2, that's all there is to say. But there's a large number of subtleties that are involved in the fact that this law is this way. And I'd like to illustrate those subtleties to you now. First, since the number that arrived is not equal to the number that arrived through one plus the number that arrived through two, at least determined this way, we will conclude, since this was an evident that this should equal this, was a consequence of proposition A, we conclude that proposition A is false. It's not true that the electrons either go through hole number one or through hole number two. That's clear, because otherwise we would deduce immediately that the probability would be the sum of the probabilities. Well, unfortunately for us, sir, we can always test any idea by experiment. And so we're going to do an experiment to find out whether or not the electrons do either go through hole number one or hole number two. So we set up the following experiment. Same situation, same hole. All holes are going to be left open this time. There's going to be a detector over here. But we're going to look at the holes. We put a source of light back here. This S, this little X represents a source of light. And electrons scatter light, as you know. So that the light waves, or whatever the hell the light is, comes out here and shines behind the holes. And we look up this way to see. When an electron goes through, there'll be a little bit of light there. When an electron goes through the bottom hole, there'll be light there. So if we make the observation, we could tell what's going on in the holes. We're going to get light from both at the same time because the electron divides in half. We're going to see waves coming out or what? So we do the experiment. Here's what we see. Every time that this man records, or that if there were a whole lot of recorders over here, so that every time there's an electron coming through, if the light's strong enough, suppose the light's very strong, so we make sure we see good, then every time we see a flash in one or another hole, a solid single flash, size one, that is, we see one electron. When we look at the electrons, every time an electron is counted on this side, then we see indeed that the light is either here scattered or here scattered, never both places. In other words, when we look, we see indeed that it's true, that the electrons either go through one hole or the other. So proposition A experimentally is necessarily so. Now we got something. If proposition A is that we go either through A or through one hole one or through hole two, then damn it, this curve must be analyzable as the number which goes through one plus the number goes through two. Here. Let's squeeze nature. You see, we'll force it this way. We'll be both experiments at once. You stand over here with the counter and count how many arrive. And I'll stand over here by the light source and I'll watch the holes. So we make a list of them that arrive. And we have two categories. Number one arrivers and number two arrivers. See, it'll go something like this. You'll say, I got one. I said, yeah, I saw that one. That was hole number one. Boom. And another one comes through. I got that one. Hole number one again. Hole number two. Hole number two. Hole number two. One, two, two, two. What is on? Therefore, I'm impressing upon you this, that every electron which is recorded can be divided into two classes. Them which come through one and them which come through two. So when I add the total number of electrons, there are two sums here. The number through one and the number through two. And if I divide by the total, of course, I get the probabilities. The probabilities don't make any difference. The numbers are just as good. So the total number which arrive at the position X can definitely be written as the sum of two curves, the N1 curve and the N2 curve. And so this thing must be the sum. Now, wait a minute. It turns out that when it must be the sum of the two pieces. Now, first, if you just look at the pieces, number one, and ask, well, how are they distributed? You discover that the number ones as a function of X, if you did the experiment with different X, is distributed like that. just the same, in fact, as I would have got if I closed number two hole, showing that there's no complicated business in going through several holes. When I watch them, they come through just like they're supposed to come through if the hole were closed or open. Those which have seemed to come through number one are distributed the same way, whether the hole two is open or closed. And when number two, one is closed, if I just look at the curve number two, the both holes are open, mind you, I'm just watching them. Then those that come through number two is this, and it's obvious, mathematically, logically impossible to be anything else, but that the curve is the sum of the two. And so indeed it is. It ain't the same as it was before. When we look at the electrons, the distribution of them on the screen is different than when we don't look. Looking at the electrons disturbs things. Electrons are very delicate. And the light waves, or whatever it is that we've shining on the electrons here, is like hitting them with a hammer as they come through. I mean, there's a terrific forces produced by the electric field of the light, or however you want to describe the light. We'll come to details in a moment. Anyway, the light makes a big influence on the electrons. It's no miracle, then, that if I turn on this bright light, and as they come through, that they're deflected from the way they would have come through if I didn't have the light on. And so the distribution, it can be understood, is different when I look. Well, you say, look, light, you know, like a wave, make it more quiet. Don't make such a hammer out of it. Turn down the intensity, build up the sensitivity of your detectors. And then you cannot imagine, there must be some kind of continuity, huh? If I keep cutting down the intensity of the light gradually towards zero, damn it, the curve for all these different experiments must somehow gradually pass from this curve to that curve. How was it done? So I turn down the intensity of light and I discover something. That light isn't really waves. Light comes in the form of photons, little bits at a time. When I turn the intensity of the light down, I don't get weaker and weaker effects. But the light itself acts like particles at sufficiently delicate point of view and carry a certain momentum, which we've already written down, Planck's constant divided by the wavelength of light and a certain energy. So when the photon hits that thing, the electron, there's an unavoidable bang in momentum, which deflects the electron from the way it was supposed to go, if you want, by this amount. And if I turn down the light, I do not change the amount by which I deflect the thing. You see, the experiment would run something like this with weak light. You set it up, we're all ready. I got to count. I saw it was through hole number one. Bing. Count. Two, number two. Count. I didn't see that one. Sometimes there's no photons. Things come in photons. It just happened at that moment there was no photon. So I have to have a third column, number one, number two, and didn't see. Because the light is in photon form, huh? And then, I'll put it in the didn't see column. And so we go. And so we find three curves. N3, the didn't sees. Now what happens? N1, already explained. N2, already explained. N3, that shape. And as I turn down the light, I get a mixture, you see. The strong light, where there's not many didn't sees, is mostly this curve. And the weak light, where they don't see hardly any of them, is mostly that curve. And so there's a continuity where it changes from one to the other. Any time that I see it, damn it, it makes this distribution. But any time that I don't see it, it makes the other. And that's understandable, because when I don't see it, no photon disturbs it. And when I do see it, a photon disturbs it. And there's a minimum amount of disturbance. There's enough to explain the difference between these two because of the momentum carried by the photon. Well, if you're sufficiently ingenious and paying enough attention, you might have already got into your head an idea. It is necessary, in order to explain the difference in the pattern from here to here, to understand that the photon kicks the electron with enough momentum to deflect it away from where it would have gone, let's say in one of the maxima, to one of the minima, at least, so that it fills up the troughs, makes a smooth curve. And we understand that this is the momentum that the light can give.
But you see that a good idea would be to make the wavelength of the light longer and longer, and thus, in that manner, make weaker and weaker the disturbance which you can understand the light could give the electron, because after all, it can't give any more than this momentum, and you need a certain finite momentum to explain the fact that it deviated from the trough to the maximum. So let's try to use longer waves. So we use longer waves all the time, and then a terrible thing happens. You remember when we discussed the microscope, we pointed out that due to the wave nature of light, there's a limitation to how close two spots can be, and you can still make them out as two spots. And this distance is of the order of the wavelength of the light. Now, when I make the wavelength bigger than the distance between these two holes, then when the light is scattered, my instruments, I can't tell whether it was scattered from here or from here because the effect looks the same. It's impossible to resolve those two independent spots. So when the wavelength is too long, I no longer can take and say, I saw it. Say, well, which hole was it? I don't know. And so, when the wavelength gets longer, as the wavelength gets longer, as it gets beyond the distance D, so that it becomes more and more difficult to be sure as to which hole it came through by the observation of the light, the curve turns into this one. Now you see that in order for this to exist, and this too, it's necessary that nature do this very carefully, and that the statement that the new laws of quantum mechanics required a specific limitation on what was possible, in short, in this experiment, is impossible to arrange the light in such a way that at the same time you can tell which hole it went through, but the effect is that it won't disturb the pattern, because then you'd be in trouble. So it was recognized by Heisenberg that there were some limitations on our experimental abilities, and this was summarized in the uncertainty principle, which I'll state in the general way, as follows. Any attempt to design apparatus to determine which hole the electron passed through here, and you can generalize that to any or some other general cases, but the general idea is the same. Any attempt to design apparatus to determine which hole the electron goes through, has passed through, and at the same time delicate enough so as to not to deflect the electron sufficiently to destroy the interference pattern, is impossible. You cannot design or build or make or anything an apparatus which can do two things. First, it's capable of determining which hole the electron goes through. And second, it's so delicate that you cannot account for a disturbance that doesn't disturb the pattern from here to here. Otherwise, there'd be a complete inconsistency in the quantum mechanics. And thus, the world must be entirely quantum mechanical. It can't be half classical and half quantum mechanical. If, for example, Shmuninos, a new particle, were to all go exactly by waves according to classical physics, that we can make any intensity we want, then we could just use them to watch the electrons, and we could cut the intensity down because they weren't photon-like, they didn't have the rules of quantum mechanics, and then we would be in a paradox. So we will be in a paradox unless all of matter, everybody, obeys the same rule. Namely, that it behaves like photonic, or they all behave the same way, a la quantum mechanics. There has been many attempts made by various people to concoct ways of beating the game, but like Monte Carlo, only even better, it has never been possible. Nobody has ever designed in any way a way to beat this game, to beat the uncertainty principle. And as far as we know, there is no exception to it. All right? Well, you say, what about proposition A? Huh? What are we going to say? The electron does it, or is it true, or isn't it true that the electron either goes through hole number one or it goes through hole number two? Well, we found from experience that we have a certain special way we have to think in order that we don't get into inconsistencies. And what we say, what physicists say, is the following. In order to avoid making wrong predictions of what will happen, they say the following. If you have a piece of apparatus which can determine whether or not it goes through hole one or hole two,
Then in law, then you can say, yes, it either goes for one or two. It will always come out when you have an apparatus that can do it, that you'll see it behind one or behind the other. In other words, when you're looking, you can say that it either goes through hole number one or hole number two. But when you have no disturbing influence, when you put nothing in there to disturb the electron, and you do not look, then do not say that either it goes through hole one or hole number two. Because if you say that and start to deduce from that, you'll find errors in the analysis. So what we do is we say that when you're not looking, you shall not say that it takes either one or two or other alternative. Only when there's equipment made to determine whether it takes one alternative or the other is it possible to say. And then you find, indeed, it takes one or the other alternative. But at the same time, you get a distribution or an effect, which is just what you'd expect if it took one or the other of alternative. But when you don't look, you get a different effect, which is not what you would get if you assumed that it took one or the other of the alternatives. This is the logical tightrope on which we have to walk if we wish to describe nature successfully. When you don't look, don't say that it has to do this or that. Only when you look. And then it does. I may remind just one point. What happens with baseballs? Suppose you put baseballs or bullets through this equipment. Well, it turns out that the wavelengths are so tiny for large objects that these interference patterns are so fine that with any finite size hole or finite equipment or anything, you can't see the ups and downs, and you get the classical curve. If this curve is made sufficiently rapid variations, very rapid phase differences, then you get this. And as you probably know from the mathematics of the light, when we add two amplitudes, if there's any reason why the phase relation between these two is rapidly varying or has to be averaged over or is unavailable to detection, then the cross term, when you take the square, averages to zero. And the square of the absolute magnitude is the sum of this square plus this square, and the other term averages out. And so P becomes equal to P1 plus P2, which is this other curve. So any circumstances where you can't get the phases definite is a case where you can just add probabilities in a normal way. And as soon as you get the large scale, the phases are so enormous that they average right out, and you can just add probabilities in the conventional way, but not on a small scale. Well, I'd like to summarize this. I've written a summary on the board, but it's also part of the lecture. I say it as follows. Here's a general rules, a generalization from this experiment, but a much more general remark. The probability of any event, and I have a certain, well, first, we have to talk about idealized experiments in which there's no external extra disturbances, because, of course, the probability distribution here would be different if there was some noise or somebody was jiggling something in there. I mean, so I'm talking about an idealized experiment where there's no uncertain external disturbances. Okay. Under those circumstances, the probability of an event is the absolute square of a complex quantity. This complex quantity is called the probability amplitude. Now, when an event can occur in more than one way, in several alternative ways, it's always true that the probability amplitude for the whole occurrence is the sum of a probability amplitude for each way that it can occur. Each way considered separately. Now, finally, if you do an experiment, or if you set up an experiment which is in fact capable of determining which alternative, which of the various ways the thing is happening, is actually taken in the equipment, if you do such an experiment, then the interference effects in the probability distribution are lost, and the probability becomes the sum of the probabilities for each alternative. In other words, when you're looking, the probability is the sum of the probabilities. But when you're not looking, the probability is a square of amplitudes for each alternative. I've written it mathematically down here. In the first, these 1, 2, 3 correspond to the same three relations over here. The first law says that the probability is equal to the square of some complex quantity, phi, let's say, for a given event. If there were several alternatives and I'd taken two, then the phi is the sum of them. So the probability of course, the square of the sum, in the way that we've been doing all the time. You write complex numbers on a diagram with little vectors and take the square of the resultant, and that's the probability. On the other hand, in case three, that is, in the situation in which there are experiments which are able to determine which way things go, then the interference term averages out in some way, and the probability is the sum of the squares or the sum of the two independent probabilities. Now you say, how does it work? Never mind all this. I mean, I got the law, okay? But what's the machinery behind the law? Nobody has any machinery behind the law. That's all. Nobody understands any more than I've just explained. Nobody will give you any deeper representation of the situation. We haven't any ideas by which this thing is a consequence. There isn't any how does it work in any mechanical sense. Isn't it some kind of gears inside the electron? No. Secondly, I'd like to emphasize the very important difference between classical and quantum mechanics. All the time we're talking about the probability that an electron will arrive in a given circumstance. I've implied then that if you had a counter here and you've arranged this experiment as perfectly as you could, it would be impossible to predict exactly what would happen. You can only predict the odds. This would mean, if it were true, that physics has given up on the problem of being able to predict what happens in definite circumstances. Well, yes, physics has given up. We do not know how to predict what would happen in given circumstances, and everybody believes that it's impossible, and that the only thing that you can predict is the probability of different events. It must be recognized that this is a retrenchment in our advance on understanding nature. This is a back motion, but nobody's beat it yet. Let me just make one remark to illustrate the difficulties. You'd say, you think you got everything under control, see? But the electron which is coming out of here, which is going to end up somewhere, has some kind of internal condition, inner hidden variables or some kind of gut work or something. You know, it's in a condition that you don't know about. And that's why you can't predict what happens. But if we could look more closely at the electron, we could see exactly where it would end up. As far as I know, that's impossible. And I'd like to explain roughly why. Because we have, of course, the probability to arrive here. But if you believe that inside the electron there's some kind of a determinant of some way, some machinery inside that determines how it's going to end up, that machine must also determine which hole it's going to go through in order to get over there, huh? No. Don't forget that what's inside the electron here shouldn't be dependent upon what we do after the electron leaves that point, what we do. What's inside shouldn't depend on that. So if I put a counter here instead of here, I would get probabilities. I get it either here or here. If I look or with light or something, I get it either here or here. So I must also be able to predict that probability. So therefore, inside the guts of this electron is not only a thing which tells me where it'll end up here, but also a thing that tells me which hole it's going to go through. And therefore, the probability of arrival here must be a sum of two effects for those which go through the two holes. But we've just verified that that isn't the case, that if we check the electrons which are going through hole one and through hole two, then we do not get an interference pattern. And no one has figured a way out of this kind of puzzle. So at the present time, we are limiting ourselves to computing probabilities. I say at the present time, but I rather very strongly suspect that it's something that will be with us forever, that it's impossible to beat that. But say to somebody that something is impossible, and you start them thinking energetically. I hope that maybe we've been able to do that. Finally, I would like to say that you probably have heard of the uncertainty principle in a different form, which is the way that Heisenberg stated originally, which is that if you make the measurement of any object, if you know its momentum with an uncertainty, delta P, you cannot at the same time know its position more accurately than delta X equals H over delta P. They like to write in a nice symmetrical form. The uncertainties in position and momentum simultaneously is greater than a Planck's constant. Now, that is a special case of the uncertainty principle, which I stated more generally. The statement I made more generally was that you cannot design an equipment to determine which alternative is taken without at the same time destroying the pattern of interference. Let me show you that by taking a specific design, I can see where this rule is necessary in order to achieve, to keep from getting into trouble. And so I do the following experiment instead of what I did before. I take this plate here, and the same source, everything the same, and I put the detector here. Now, we're going to get more subtle. See, instead of looking with light, we're going to do this. Isn't it true that the electron which comes here, in a classical sense at least, is bent a different amount, is kicked a different amount than the one that goes through there? And therefore, isn't it to be expected that if electron is supposed to have in some sense momentum, a detail which we'll discuss later, next time, and the other has momentum, that the momentum deflection is greater in the one case than the other? Here, let me take the case that we're detecting in dead center. Then in the one case, the screen receives upward momentum. In the other case, the screen receives some downward momentum. No, I have an ingenious idea without disturbing anybody. Nobody's going to be disturbed. I put this thing on rollers, you see. Now, I said at the beginning, I set it so it's not moving at all, and it's right here. That an electron comes through. Okay, you got it? Yeah, I'll say, wait just a minute. Now, watch, boom, 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 it's moving up. Okay, that's hole number one. Then I bring this thing back to the beginning again. I set it down, I let go, I wait. Another electron, boom, it's moving down because of the momentum given to it. In other words, the screen takes up the recoil of the electron, and by detecting which direction the screen is going, I determine which hole it went through. Now, look here. I have not disturbed the electron that time. But in order to do this, it's necessary to know ahead of time what the momentum of the screen is, of course. I mean, it would certainly not do for this that somebody comes and shakes, makes the screen move, you see. I don't know how much. Then I turn around and I look. It's moving down. But that may be because it was moving down faster before, and it was when the electron went up, you see. And I have to be sure at the beginning that I know that what the momentum of the screen is. I have to have the vertical momentum of the screen accurate enough to do the experiment. But according to the uncertainty principle, I cannot at the same time know the position of the screen. And if I don't know where these two holes are, every time I do the experiment, the two holes are in a different place. You see, by having determined the momentum accurately, and the uncertainty principle tells me if I try to set the screen at a definite momentum, I at the same time can't be sure that I've got the holes in the right place. So every time an electron goes through, the holes are in a different place. Now, the pattern for the holes in one place is like this, but if the holes are moved up a little bit, the pattern is like this, of course, moved over. So every electron that comes through is feeding the pattern in a different position. So I never can get the pattern. I get the smear of the pattern over all possible positions, and that's this curve again. So the uncertainty principle protects the quantum, the quantum mechanics. Heisenberg recognized that if it were possible to measure the momentum and the position simultaneously with an accuracy greater than H, the quantum mechanics would collapse. So he proposed that it should be impossible. And then people, all the experimenters, sat down and tried to figure out ways of doing it. And nobody could figure out a way to measure the position and the momentum of anything, a screen, an electron, a billiard ball, anything, with any greater accuracy than that. And that's so. Quantum mechanics maintains its existence, its perilous but accurate existence.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.